Welcome to episode 3 of the Olasky Interview. I'm Jill Nelson. Today, Marvin Olasky's 2018 interview with Mez McConnell. McConnell is the senior pastor of Nidri Community Church in Edinburgh, Scotland, and the author of 3 books. He's passionate about planting churches in poor communities and keeping the gospel central in compassion or mercy ministries. McConnell grew up in a rough neighborhood and became involved in violent crime at a young age. His life was on a downward spiral until some Christians came to visit him in prison, and he eventually wanted to know more about God. Marvin Olasky is here to share some of his thoughts about this interview. Hi, Marvin.
Hi, Jill.
Well, looking back on the list of people you've interviewed through the years, not many are from overseas. And Mez McConnell, of course, as we mentioned, is a pastor from Scotland. How did someone from across the pond attract your interest?
One of my students interned with him in Glasgow, in Scotland, and she turned me on to his memoir about growing up abandoned and abused. It's pretty brutal in parts. And he responded. He was convicted of assault at age 12, and then he came to Christ by plowing through Matthew Henry's Bible commentary from the 18th century. Not a whole lot of conversion stories like that over the past couple of centuries.
Yeah, you don't hear that very often. Well, I quickly picked up that McConnell has a sense of humor and is just this down-to-earth kind of guy. He calls you Doc throughout the interview, not Dr. Olasky, just Doc. And he's refreshingly straightforward when it comes to sharing the gospel. Tell us how his approach might differ from that of other pastors.
Yeah, I liked being called Doc, kind of like one of the dwarfs, right? There's Grumpy and Happy and Sleepy and Doc.
That's not the image I had in mind. I was thinking more professor.
Yeah. But here's one thing that's interesting about his approach. Reformed churches, that is churches that emphasize God's sovereignty, man's corruption, they have the reputation for being often intellectual places where pastors maybe give university-type sermons. Mez is really different. He's thoroughly reformed. He hits hard on sin, but he doesn't say that he and others are innocent bystanders who just had a terrible upbringing and are products of their environment and thus don't have responsibility. He emphasizes that all of us are sinners.
What is his criticism of typical middle-class programs to help the poor?
Well, he says in Scotland, and I've been to Scotland a little bit, saw some of this, and saw more of it in the U.S., so I think he's right. He says they celebrate because 50 people come to a soup kitchen or a food pantry, and then 6 months later, the same 50 are there, maybe 50 more, and a year after that, it's still the same people. So year after year after year, the middle-class programs, he says, are sustaining people in poverty rather than challenging them to climb out of it.
Marvin Olasky is editor-in-chief at World and the author of more than 20 books. Marvin, thanks.
Thank you, Jill.
In just a moment, you'll hear Marvin Olasky's 2018 conversation with Mez McConnell. This interview took place in front of an audience at Patrick Henry College.
The Olasky Interview Podcast is made possible by listeners like you. Additional support comes from Samaritan Ministries, a biblical solution to healthcare, where members live out Galatians 6:2 by bearing one another's burdens through prayer and financial support when there's a medical need. More at SamaritanMinistries.org/worldpodcast.
I understand from your writing that your mom ran off when you were 2 years old.
That's right, yeah.
Leaving you, and you had a 3-year-old sister with your grandma?
Yeah.
Okay. Your dad was away a lot, liked to bet on horses, and not bet very successfully, I suspect?
No. He liked to bet on horses, watch football, and drink.
Okay. There's a person you refer to as she,
yeah.
Your stepmother.
Yeah.
Not a nice person, I guess.
No.
So what did she do to you?
She was highly abusive and violent, yeah.
Okay. But it gets better in Mez's life. At 12, you start taking drugs.
Yeah,
right?
that was much more fun.
Okay. Age what, 16, convicted of assault? Is that about right?
No, age 12.
Age 12, okay. Assaulting who or what or when and where?
Assaulting a couple of people.
Okay, at age 12?
Yeah.
other 12-year-olds or adults or?
Older people, yeah.
Okay. All right. You had a friend stabbed to death.
Yeah.
What happened there?
He was stabbed to death. He was a friend of mine. We were 15, and actually a girlfriend of mine at the time just took a knife and stuck it straight through his heart.
Okay. And through all this, you are starting to ask spiritual questions?
Yeah. I was wondering what, you know, when my friend died, obviously, one minute we're having a cigarette and having a crack, and the next minute he was bleeding to death in the back of the car on the way to the hospital.
Okay.
And so I began to wonder, where was he, what was happening, what was going on?
Okay. Did you have anyone at that point to help you think through those questions?
Not really, no. I mean, I've grown up in a pretty Irish Catholic sort of background, sporadically, but nobody really, no.
Okay. So then you're homeless for a while?
Homeless at 16.
Homeless at 16. Okay. You got involved in a fight in a nightclub, stabbed a couple of people. Is that accurate?
Yeah.
Okay, you write that you could have escaped, but you just stood there in a way. After you stabbed these guys, you waited to get caught?
Yeah.
Okay, because you at that point you wanted to get caught? Or you
yeah,
just...
I think so. At that point, I was messed up.
Okay.
And so prison seemed like a good idea.
Okay. Then you meet some Christians, right? In prison, or...?
No, I'd met some Christians around about the same time as I was involved in the stabbing incident. I'd met some Christians a few months beforehand.
Okay.
And then when I went, I got sent to Max Security. Then these Christians came to see me in prison, yeah.
Okay, they came to see you.
Yeah.
And what types of things did you talk about with them?
Nothing, I can't remember. I mean, they only came to see me one time. I was like 300 miles from where they lived in a maximum security prison. So you got a 15-minute visit. So they brought me some tobacco and a radio. So they brought me tobacco. That doesn't probably make them very good Christians, does it?
I'm just going to move right past that one.
You can edit that out of the YouTube thing.
So.
They brought me candy and an AV.
Okay, you write that they actually talked to me like I was a human being.
Yeah.
Previously, people had talked to you like what?
So previously, when I lived on the streets and I was running around the place, and I'd met these Christians previously, they were very like all in my face about God and sin and heaven and hell, and nothing they said was untrue looking back, but at the time, you know, it was very stark and cold and just seemed like these sort of rich, sort of preppy looking dudes.
Okay.
Didn't have a clue about my life, were just driving in their nice cars, telling me how bad I was, then driving back to their perfect lives. And so, and they came to see me in prison. They actually didn't talk about anything spiritual, they just brought me some stuff, asked me how I was doing, and I was actually more affected by the fact that they seemed to genuinely talk to me as a human rather than a project.
Okay. So then you get on probation, right?
I got probation, yeah.
You asked if you could stay with a Christian guy for a while?
I couldn't get parole because the nature of my offenses were violent. I was on what we call license for about 20 years, and I didn't have an address. I was homeless. And so the only way I could get parole is if I had an address. And so this Christian dude offered me somewhere to live. And so obviously I'm like, oh yeah, I'll take the address. And that's how I got paroled.
Okay, then what happened? When did you start really hearing about Christ?
So I moved to their house and it was like, you know, quite a nice house. And Christians would come round and do sort of Christian-y things, you know.
Christian-y things,
you know, like... talk about Jesus and read the Bible and pray and weird stuff like that. And then I would watch these dudes. It was a bit like watching the scene from The Waltons,
right.
Like these people just lived in another world to me.
Okay.
I mean, I went around with, you know, murderous thieves, drug dealers, and so I was just watching these dudes. Wasn't really into it. I was more into the drugs and the violence. But inside I was thinking, man, I wish I could be as chilled out. They didn't seem really affected by life and they seemed to have like a peace that I never had. My life was just frantic all the time. And so actually one of them invited me away to a sort of Christian youth weekend. which okay. I was very suspicious about.
A Christian Youth Weekend.
Yeah.
Did you do it?
I did do it, but I set some ground rules. Like, if you try to brainwash me, I'll just murder all of you.
Right. Which would probably keep them quiet a little bit.
Well, at the time, you may remember this, Doc, because you're old enough. David Koresh?
Yeah, David Koresh, yeah.
Waco? That was all over the news.
Okay.
So I thought whack jobs, right?
Right.
They were all in a compound, right? Having a youth meeting or whatever.
Right.
And that went bad. And I'm thinking, come to a youth meeting and hear about Jesus. I'm thinking, Waco, right? And so you've got to understand culturally, and this is 20 years ago, it's worse now. Culturally, guys from my communities, we don't understand a thing about the Bible or Christianity or anything to do with cultural heritage of the Lord. And so this is just freakish to us. And so I went, just because I owed a few drug dealers money, to be honest, and I just wanted to get out of town for a bit. And I thought, I'm a small guy, but I looked around, I was pretty confident I could take most people, so if they try and brainwash me, I was confident in my ability to handle the situation.
So what happened?
So I heard about weird stuff like the blood of the lamb and redemption and just weird stuff, right? Words you'd never hear in your life. So I thought that was weird. I observed them. I went to church for the first time, a Welsh chapel.
Okay.
It was just the worst experience of my life. I think I would have rather have done a hard time than go to church.
Okay.
It was just mind-numbing. I didn't understand what was being said. They sort of prayed, as I recall now, it was, and this is not a commentary on that, there was that language as well, old AV language, King James language, and used the King James. It was very, very just foreign. So I just was bored by it. Although I was interested in Jesus. I quite liked Jesus because Jesus seemed to me to be a real pain in the neck.
Right.
To people in authority, and that quite appealed to me. And so I left that weekend, decided I'm going to find out more about Jesus. And that's what then started me seriously on the road to the Lord saving my soul, really.
Okay, so how were you going to learn more about Jesus?
Well, I found an old book in this dude's house. It was a Matthew Henry commentary on the Bible.
Okay.
You see one of those bad boys?
Yeah.
They're bigger than me.
Yeah.
And I got a friend to help me carry it onto a table. Right. I didn't, Doc. I'm pretty strong. Mm-hmm. So I thought, I'll read this thing, right? I mean, I just thought it was a Bible. I didn't know anything. So I read it from start to finish. It took me a couple of months, but I read it. And
now, Matthew Henry's commentary, he always has the Bible verses there, and then he talks about them, writes about them. So you were getting a lot of Bible and a lot of Matthew Henry on that? Okay, interesting.
So I was just cranking through that bad boy.
Okay. So then what?
I got converted reading the book of Romans. That's a cheeky book to get converted by, right?
And just reading, there wasn't someone...
No, I mean, ask questions. You get to Leviticus and that, you're like, what?
Right.
Don't wear this and that and, stand in the presence of the aged and stuff. So I was asking people, what's the crack with this? Is this still... And so I was asking Christians questions. And then, I got through that and then I got into the New Testament. And the book of Romans just resonated with me. Because I'd been taught lies my entire life, largely by social workers and drug counselors. They just lied to me blatantly.
And what were some of the lies that were most common?
Well, the biggest lie was this, that I wasn't really a bad person, that I was a good guy, that I'd been... had a terrible upbringing, a terribly abusive childhood. I was a product of my environment. And if I had come from a good, stable home with both parents, et cetera, then I wouldn't have made the life choices I made, et cetera. And so I'm like, yeah. So, screw you, screw the world.
So they're saying you are not responsible.
Exactly, right? I'm a victim, And then I'm confronted with Paul, I'll transliterate, who says, nah, son. You need to take responsibility for yourself, for your actions. Boo-hoo, you had a tough childhood, but you are a sinner standing in front of a holy God, and there's no excuse for your sin, regardless of how people mistreated you. And so when I was confronted with my sinfulness, being forced to take responsibility for how I'd lived my life as a rebel against a holy God, man, that just annoyed me. No end.
It annoyed you.
Oh, yeah.
But also, it changed you.
Well, it annoyed me, but that's what led me to repentance and faith in Christ. So initially my response was, what? No chance. It's not my fault.
So you had to be annoyed. In other words, if it had just been nice, you're wonderful.
Oh, yeah. Like if it had been nice, great. It's not your fault. Give me a hug. You know, that would just do my nut in, Doc.
Okay.
So I was converted, gave my life to Christ on my own in a park bench. That's it.
And tell us exactly what happened there. You say you gave your life to Christ. What were you thinking? What were you saying?
So, I mean, I was still on the drugs, right? I was smoking about 60 cigarettes a day. I was a mess, right? And so I'm like, right, how do you do this crack? No one sort of tells you how to be a Christian, right? And so I was going for a walk. I was like, right, what I'm going to do is this, God. And I'm not sure of the theological veracity of this, what happened, but the Lord's pretty gracious, right? So I'm like, so listen, God, we'll do a deal. This is how it's going to go down. I'm going to give up the drugs and, you know, the cigarettes and all and the just ridiculousness. And you're going to help me understand what this Bible crack is all about and Jesus, right? So I sat down on a bench. I'm like, right, I'm a sinner. Obviously, I'm a sinner. I mean, I felt a bit dumb talking to myself, right? But, you know, we'll go with it. I made sure there was no one around. I didn't want to get arrested, right? So I'm a sinner. There's no doubt about that. And that's a fact. I'll take that one on the chin, God. And Jesus died on the cross. I've no idea what that really means. But I know I'm a sinner. And somehow, Jesus dying, I trust in you. You forgive me. So just help me do that. Not exactly the sinner's prayer, but probably a bit more theologically rigorous, I would suspect.
Right.
And then that was it. And then I wasn't sure, so I went and talked to this Christian friend of mine. I said, listen, I think I've become one of you Christian-y people. And he's like, what? What's going on? I said, well, you know, I think I'm a sinner. Well, no, I know I'm a sinner. I know God's holy. I can't sleep at night. I can't stop thinking about God. I can't stop thinking about my sin. I can't stop thinking about Jesus. It's doing my head in. So I've prayed this sort of prayer. Is that good? So he prayed with me, and then I started meeting with this guy almost every day to study the Bible. Then I was just straight into the Bible. I was eating the Bible all day.
So I'm just thinking, you know, in the hymn Amazing Grace, you know, that saved a wretch like me.
Mm-hmm.
And there are some people in the United States, I don't know if people do it in Scotland, but there's some people in the United States who say, oh, we don't like to say wretch. So they changed the word, you know, that saved someone like me.
Yeah.
But you had to understand that you were a wretch.
Oh, yeah. Right? People who don't like the word wretch, they're wretches, aren't they?
So,
simple as that.
Okay, now you're actually studying. You're taking classes and so forth.
No, I'm meeting with a guy.
You're meeting with a guy.
It's a guy in a church who's just meeting with me. I'm asking, you know, it's like when you're first Christian. I'm banging all the questions out, reading the Bible. I'm just like, what about this and this and this? And this guy was just meeting with me, helping me understand the scriptures.
Okay.
I started going to church. I just didn't get church.
Okay.
I didn't like it.
Okay, so then what? You don't like the church. You're reading the Bible.
Yeah.
You're asking questions.
Mm-hmm.
And at a certain point, you start thinking, okay, I'm learning this, but I can certainly see in the Bible the church is important, so we have to have better churches.
That took me a long time.
Okay. Give us the process, because you're 45 right now.
Yeah.
So we're talking about a 20-year process.
Yeah.
And so just take us through how that...
Yeah, and so I mean, at first... few months. I mean, I'm like every Christian. I was an absolute nut job for Jesus. And so, I'd be back on the streets evangelizing my friends, telling them, listen, get off the crack pipe and get to church, or you're going to hell. Wasn't much more nuanced than that. A lot of guys were coming to faith. The Lord was convicting them. But I mean, I didn't have anything in the armory. I had Jesus saved me. That's it, baby. I couldn't tell you anything else. But then someone said to me, why don't you like try and go to like a Bible school or something? I'm like, what, that exists? Like a school? You can just go and learn about the Bible? Sign me up for that, bad boy. So 9 months in, I went to a seminary, got my first degree. Studied there for 3 years. That was up and down. Then, I was in and out. I was a member of a home church, but, you know, I wasn't really like, committed to the church. I was more in love with Jesus. For me, it was Jesus. What the church was sort of just this place you sort of had to go to. I never quite understood why in the early years. You go and sit in a room with loads of strangers, sing songs about Jesus, pretend you like each other, then leave. And then I, after I left seminary, I became an associate pastor at a church.
What kind of church?
It was a Baptist church.
Okay. In a poor place or?
No, in a rich church.
In a rich church.
Oh, yeah. These people were minted, Doc.
Okay. So how was that?
They wouldn't send their kids to a low-life place like this. These people had money, right?
Right.
And that was terrible. So I resigned after about 8 months.
Why did they hire you?
Because I was a good evangelist and I was good with their young people. I was on placement there as a seminary student. And then What happened was the minister who hired me left in my last year, and they hired a guy who was basically, he was heterodox. He was didn't believe that the Bible was the entire word of God. Da, 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 da. Then he ran into me. And I'm like, I was working when he got there, and it was just an absolute car crash.
Okay.
And so I resigned, and then I walked away from the church for about a year.
What did you do? During that year?
I went and did some work. Me and my wife, we lived near our in-laws in England. I did some work. And then an older guy called Stuart Olliott. Have you heard of Stuart Olliott?
I haven't, no.
You ought to Google Stuart Olliott.
How do you spell his last name?
O-L-Y-O-T-T.
Okay.
So he's an amazingly gifted Welsh preacher from the Martin Lloyd-Jones School.
Okay.
And he got in touch with me and said, look, come and do a master's with me, a theological seminary in Wales. I'm like, nah, I don't want to. He's an old school pastor, really godly, wise, convinced me to come back, introduced me to a church that were looking for a youth pastor. I was very suspicious, but you know, I took this guy's advice on board. So this church took me in. They loved me. They sort of nursed me back from the brink, really. So I never wanted to leave the faith. I just didn't like the church, politics, people. It seemed like guys like from my background, we're great for testimony night. But put us in authority, and the middle-class power brokers don't like it.
Okay.
And so I was very suspicious. But anyway, I got over that, repented of my sin, obviously. Ended up spent a few years there, great years, great church, godly leaders, amazing.
As a youth pastor?
As a youth pastor.
So now, what kind of church was that as far as wealth and poverty?
A mix.
Okay. So when you talk with rich kids, I mean, how did you connect with them?
What do you mean, Doc?
Well, you know, when you're talking with someone from your background.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay, there's a lot in common.
Yeah.
What's in common there? I mean,
rich kids are like poor kids, right?
Yeah, but how do they understand when they've been sort of fawned over and everything's come?
Yeah, yeah.
You know, how do they understand that they are wretches?
Yeah.
Also.
You just tell them, Doc.
Okay. And they understand because they're...
Well, they do. They're scumbags. They just dress nicer.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. So that works. It's not something you don't... There's not a different gospel for rich people or poor people.
No. It's the power of the gospel.
Okay.
It's one gospel. Simple as.
Okay. God saves sinners. We are
listen,
sinners. God
nicely
is holy.
Dressed rich people are the most duplicitous people on the planet.
Because there's a tendency to think...
Because wealth and education and erudition, they're easy masks to hide sin.
Right.
People say, oh, how do you deal with all the drug addicts and losers in your ministry? It must be so difficult. I'm like, no, there's loads of drug addicts and losers in your world. They just hide it better.
Right, yeah.
Easy to hide being a loser when you're driving a nice Mercedes, right?
Yeah, and the kids know that. They can
see that. Oh, yeah, kids knew that, yeah.
Okay.
If they didn't, they knew it by the time we'd finished having a discussion.
Right, right. Okay, then what?
And then I ended up going to Brazil. At this point I'm married with children. We'd been pursuing Brazil, street gangs, for some time. And I went and planted a church.
In Rio or?
In this north in a city called São Luís.
Okay.
Which is right just below the Amazon.
Okay.
Belém is on the Amazon. And then the next city down below the equator is called São Luís,
okay.
City of about 1 million people.
Okay.
And so we started the first Christian ministry to street gangs in the city. We planted a church, we started a school, we started two schools, doctor's surgery, dental surgery. So,
okay, same gospel there.
Same gospel, baby.
And people understand.
People understand. There's a difference, Doc, between people not accepting and not understanding. People understand. Whether they accept or not is irrelevant, but they understand.
So why do we hear so often, well, you have to be kind of soothing in your sermons, you have to be careful not to alienate anyone, or why do we hear that when it so obviously is ineffective?
Yeah, because people are wretches and they don't like it.
So, okay, so you're in Brazil then?
Yes, we stayed there 4 years.
Okay.
So a massive, pretty much revival. It was ridiculous. Just people being converted. We grew a church from nothing. And then right bang in the middle of this just amazing period of fruit in our ministry, we felt the Lord saying, you need to leave, like, you know, Philip in Samaria, and goes from this great ministry of amazing fruit to go and into the wilderness to talk to a eunuch, right?
Okay.
So that
brings you back to Scotland.
That brought us back to Scotland. So I was convicted to come back to Scotland through, basically, on furlough. I was at my dad's 50th birthday. And so we got convicted at that birthday party that we should come back to the UK.
How exactly did that happen?
Do you want the story?
I do want the story, yes.
Right, so the story involves a stripper. Right?
They know what strippers are.
That's cool. Yeah. So my family aren't believers, obviously. My brothers are doing time for, like, murder and all sorts of things, right? So I come from a quite dangerous family. And my stepmother rang me and said, oh, your dad's 50th. We're having a surprise party. Will you come? I'm like, yeah, I'll come. And she said, right, well, why don't you pay for the stripper? And I'm like, listen, don't know how many times I need to tell you this, but I'm a minister now. And I'll pay for the DJ, right? But I'm not paying for the stripper, right? That's just not happening. She's like, oh, okay. They don't really get it, right? She's like, oh, but it's all God's creation. Surely he likes the naked form and all that. I'm like, that's a good attempt at exegesis. Not quite where we're going to go. So anyway, so I turn up at this do with my wife and that. And this is a rough do, right? And I'm talking, it's a rough do. Guys with guns, you know, more heroin, that sink a ship. And then anyway, that I come in, and everyone's like, oh, Mez, because I used to be wild. I mean, I was wild, right? And they're like, oh, look, you're a minister now. And they're all taking the mic, and they had a karaoke, and they're all singing songs, just taunting me, right, all night. And then the stripper comes in, and I'm like, I get up with my wife to leave. And people are all just throwing things at me and just swearing and blah, 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 right? Just loads of abuse. You can imagine it, right? Or maybe you can't, but trust me, these places are rough. And she did her thing and then left. And then I came back in. And then all night for about 4 hours, one after another, all these guys came and sat at my table and told me why their lives were car crashes, train wrecks. And I shared the gospel 40, 50 times. Easy, right, with these dudes. All tough guys.
I'm just thinking of the scene. So you're having this conversation.
Yeah.
Is the stripper still active?
No, she's gone.
She's gone.
So I come back in.
Okay, gotcha.
Trust me, Drucker, there's no stripper evangelism. I mean, okay. I'm pretty out there, but you know what I mean? I'm pretty orthodox, Doc.
All right.
And I've got my clothes on. It's all good at this point.
All right. Glad to hear it.
Okay,
yeah.
So...
Yeah.
So they're coming up and speaking to me, right? So all these guys have been abusing me, blah, 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 the strip, and da-da-da-da. What's happened? What's changed? Da-da-da. And I remember, and then my dad came and sat with me. And I've been estranged from my dad a long time, and my dad's talking to me, blah, blah, blah. And I'm like, listen, Dad. And there was loads of real hardcore gangsters around. A lot of them are actually now dead. And I remember it, and I said to him, listen, here's your issue. You need to get yourself along to a church, Pops. You need to get yourself a lot of church and hear the gospel. He said, I hear what you're saying, son, but I haven't got the bottle. I'm too scared to go to church. So you've got to imagine this, right? I'm sitting in a room, you wouldn't even, none of you wouldn't last in. Armed people, drug dealers, hardcore criminals. He doesn't blink at that, but he's too scared to go to church because he couldn't handle it. He's too afraid. And immediately I knew we need to come back to the UK because theologically, I'm a theologically reformed Baptist, right, all the way. And we particularly have left the poor places, the poor communities, and written them off. And there's hundreds, thousands, tens of thousands of people that my dad and my brothers and my cousins and nephews who were too scared to go to churches, and even if they could go to churches, they don't exist in our communities. And so at that moment, I knew, I'm like, now we got to leave and come back and do ministry in our communities in the United Kingdom. And then that's when I came to Scotland.
Okay. So then how long have you been at your church?
This is 11 years now.
11 years. Okay. And now you're planting other churches, I understand.
Yeah, so now we have, including us, we have 7 churches or plants in 5 cities.
Okay. And how do you train then the people who are coming in to be pastors there? What's your process then of trying to, in a sense, give them the same DNA that you have?
I mean, you can't give the DNA that I have because we really need a new generation of what we call cultural outsiders.
Okay.
So we need a generation of young men and women who are willing to forego the comforts of life and move into our communities, plant and revitalize churches, and grow a new generation of indigenous converts who will then, in 10 or 20 years, be the future church leaders. We're miles away. I mean, people in my scheme haven't had a gospel church for 30, 40, 50 years. We're in a mess. A really bad mess, and it's going to require a true old-school pioneering missionary mindset. The problem we've got in the UK is that Christianity is almost encased in a middle-class, tertiary-educated bubble. Hmm. And what happens with tertiary-educated, middle-class people is this is how they see the world. You have children, you get a house, you get married, you get a nice house or whatever, get a job, get a house. You get your kids, save up for their kids' university education. They save up, they get to university, they want to go and they want to get a house and da-da-da-da-da. But nobody wants to come into the hard, poor communities. Everybody wants to escape from those and move up the ladder. Mm-hmm. And I'm saying, well, I don't quite read the Bible like that. And we've left lots, huge, historically, Reformed evangelicals were at the forefront of true mercy ministries, hospitals, schooling, for the poor. We've left that behind. And we've left this whole swathe of the population to theological fruitcakes, mm-hmm. you know, charismatic fruit nuts, liberals, and the Reformed Church needs to get a grip of itself.
So a lot of middle-class churches in the United States set up mercy ministries.
Yeah.
And I take it from what we were talking about dinner is that you're not really thrilled with that typical approach. What's the problem with that for you, see?
I think most mercy ministries in most churches in the Western world need to be closed down today because they're not helping the poor at all. In fact, they're doing the reverse. They're helping middle-class Christians feel good about themselves because they're helping poor people. Or they think they're showing the love of Jesus to poor people because they've opened a soup kitchen or given them a handout. But in actuality, they're not really helping anybody. Not in the long term anyway. And certainly not in a biblical fashion.
Okay, so what is showing the love of Jesus? What should that really mean? What should that really look like?
I mean, showing the love of Jesus is first and foremost in proclaiming the truths of the gospel. I mean, Jesus came because there's a problem, right? It's no good saying there's not a problem or denying the problem or taking out the word wretched because it offends people. Jesus came because there's a sin problem that needs to be dealt with. Doesn't matter whether you live behind a gated community or whether you live under a bridge. You are separated from a holy God because of your sinful rebellion. And people need to hear, listen, eternal hell is a reality. But here's the good news, baby. You don't have to go there. Well, if you turn from your sinful lifestyle and put your faith and trust in Christ alone for salvation, and he'll forgive you. That's the good news. And so I think first and foremost, mercy ministry and showing the love of Jesus is preaching the gospel of Christ. And if you don't get that, you're an idiot, in my opinion.
So a lot of mercy ministries really emphasize passing out food and so forth. Is that actually counterproductive because it might keep people in poverty rather than challenging them to, let's say someone who reads World and reads what you've just said and that really resonates with them And they're thinking, okay, how do I turn my church from something that's just kind of a government look-alike passing out food but not really proclaiming Jesus? Where would such a church start?
So, I mean, I'm involved in church planting now, nearly 20 years. And so often guys who like to be trendy and dead on will say to me, I'm thinking about starting a mercy ministry, you know, helping out, taking my launch group or my core group and my home group or my small group, and we're going to go and help at a soup kitchen in the city just to show the world the love of Jesus. And I'm like, why? Or they're going to start one in the church. And my question is, why? Why are you starting this? What's the purpose of it? To show the love of Jesus. Okay, what's the love of Jesus? Well, just to show people that, you know, Christians love, whatever. What's the purpose? The purpose of any activity we take as Christians and in the world is at its basic core missionary. And what I mean by that is we exist to serve Jesus, don't we? And to proclaim the gospel to the dying world, regardless of what that looks like. And so the purpose of any ministry in the church, whether it's youth ministry, music ministry, whatever, you guys have a ministry for everything, right, Americans, and mercy ministry is surely at its base to reach out with the love of the gospel of Jesus Christ. Okay, I can dig that. But in mercy ministry, this is what happens. So 50 homeless guys turn up at your soup kitchen or your food pantry, whatever you want to call it, right? And you're handing out food, and maybe you chat to a couple of them about Jesus, and it's high fives. 50 people came last night. We're a roaring success, right? But the problem is the next week, the same 50 guys come, and 6 months later, it's the same 50 guys. 12 months, 2 years. Listen, I was in soup kitchens for 6 years. I know the drill. Mm-hmm. And the same core of people are coming. And what's happening is they're not being helped to be moved on. They're just using that situation to get what they need. Let me put it another way. So in the sort of international development community world, you know, Red Cross, etc., there's three main principles in what they call mercy. So there's relief, rehabilitation, and development. You've read this stuff, right? Mm-hmm. And so relief is, for instance, a tsunami wipes through a town. What's relief do? Relief goes in. It doesn't ask, should I carry the Bible or should I carry bread, right? Relief goes, we go in and we help people. We don't question what's going on. We get them on their feet, right? Stage two in development is rehabilitation. And rehabilitation says, right, we've helped them, they've dealt with the immediate emergent crisis. Now we need to try and help these people rehabilitate themselves to their standard of living pre-crisis. You see? So pre-tsunami, they had houses, etc. Well, let's get them. That's rehabilitation. But the third stage of development is development, funnily enough. Let's help people develop beyond their pre-crisis conditions. Gotcha. To help others. What churches have done is this. They've looked at that model. Often unwittingly, often they've not thought about it like this, and they've just gone for relief. So most mercy ministry in churches is a relief mindset. Let's give people stuff. It's not wrong to give people food. I'm not saying don't do it. I'm saying it's being done wrong. Let's give them food. Let's give them clothing. Let's give them, you know, whatever, vouchers. I'm fine with that. But 10 years later, if that's all you've done, you've never taken anybody out of relief. You've kept them a prisoner there. And so if you think, let's Christianize it, let's go for evangelism, discipleship, and service. That's how I do it. So my relief is evangelism. You know the immediate relief you need in this situation? Of course I'll give you some food. You need Jesus. And then I need to disciple you. I need to disciple you and show you and teach you and model to you what it means to be a Christian and to go in Christ. And then when I read the Bible, I read this. My job as a pastor is to prepare all God's people for works of service, not just the ones with university degrees, mm-hmm. but the guys with no teeth and tattoos. They've got a service. They're saved to serve Jesus. And so in my development, I call it service. My job is to get the guy from the soup kitchen. The Lord saves them. That's his job. Disciple them and then equip them for works of service. But pretty much 100% of all westernized mercy ministries in local churches stops at relief. Mm-hmm. Years after we should have moved people on. And what I'm saying is, how many guys from my background, Doc, do you know who are pastors, preachers, and teachers? And when you think of the billions of dollars a year piled into these so-called ministries of mercy by Christians, you know, if that was the business world, the outcomes are so ridiculously negligible. But Christians just persist on doing these things to ease their consciences.
Yeah.
Rant over. Is that enough?
That's enough. Please join me in thanking Ms. McConnell for coming tonight.
That was Marvin Olasky's 2018 conversation with Pastor Mez McConnell. This interview took place in front of an audience at Patrick Henry College. I'm Jill Nelson. Thanks for joining us.
Additional support comes from Samaritan Ministries, a community of Christians who, through prayer, encouragement, and financial support, will care for you when you have a medical need. When the body of Christ comes together to provide for one another, burdens are lifted and God is glorified. This applies to all areas of life, including healthcare. More at SamaritanMinistries.org/worldpodcast.